So now we get to the final kind of government intervention in prices, namely minimum price control. price, y-axis, quantity, and x-axis, falling demand curve, supply line. And a minimum price control, the government says, thou shalt not sell a certain product or service below a certain price. And we're keeping it above the market equilibrium. When the government does that, they set up a situation where much less will be sold than is supplied. In other words, supply is as much and quantity demand is much less because the price is higher, supply is greater than demand, and there's an unsold surplus. In a free market situation, there's an unsold surplus, prices fall, they have to cut their prices because the surplus piles up, and you wind up back here with a equating supply and demand at the market clearing price, and you eliminate the surplus. But if the government says, no, you can't do that, it's illegal to sell a product for less than this, you then have a permanent surplus. And the surplus piles up and gets worse over time because, if anything, with a higher price, they're tempted to have more, increased production even more than that, and they have to keep buying that up or whatever. So you wind up with even more surpluses over time. Surplus gets worse and worse as time goes on, just like a shortage gets worse and worse with maximum price control. There are two big examples of minimum price control, relevant examples. The first one we'll deal with today is the whole farm question, which has been totally screwed up now for about almost 60 years, and so it shows no signs of improving. In fact, probably getting worse. And the other is the minimum wage law, which we'll get to on Thursday. Basically, the way the farm situation started is that it was back in World War I. It goes back, everything starts with World War I, as a matter of fact. In the case of the farm question, just before World War I, when Europe was at war and we weren't, we came in 1917, they were blockading each other. In other words, the warring countries were blockading each other. They couldn't buy any food from each other. On the other hand, the United States was neutral, and so they bought a lot of food from the United States. So what you had was an artificial increase in the demand curve for farm products, wheat, cotton, corn, that sort of stuff. And so, of course, that means a tremendous increase in farm prices and an expansion of farm production. And this continued during war, when we got into the war, because then we have the United States government was buying stuff and shipping it abroad and so forth and so on. So you had, in other words, before and during World War I, an artificial increase in farm prices and farm production. The farmers never had it so good before or since, in a relative sense. So after the war was over, there's a big drop. Of course, everybody goes back to normal. There's a drop in European demand for American farm production. The demand curve goes back to before, more or less, and prices fall. Okay, and since production is now here, it means you have a big agricultural depression in the United States. This happens usually after every war. But in World War I, this gave rise to the farm bloc, just after the first appearance of the farm bloc as an organized force. And the farm bloc, ever since then, has been trying to live the way the farmers would like to have become accustomed back before World War I. In other words, they wanted the same relative income, relative price structure, now as they had in 1910, 1914 period. And what they did is they called this parity. Half the battle in any kind of and political struggle is to find a good name for what you want. If you want to get a monopoly privilege, you don't call it monopoly. It doesn't sound good. You call it fairness or some other crap. In this case, you call it parity. Who can be against parity, right? So parity is defined as the same relative price to farm prices relative to all other prices as existed in the 1910, 1914 period, the peak in American history before and since. In other words, you take an index of wheat prices or cotton prices relative to other prices, manufactured products, labor, whatever, wage rates, and they were their peak in this period. Okay, so the farmers, ever since then, have been insisting on going back to the good old days of parity and getting, of course, the government to do it for them. Now the thing about agriculture is the general trend in life, as civilization develops, the trend is away from the farm. In other words, say in 1789, when the American Republic was founded, everybody was a farmer. I'd say 95% of the people were farmers, and the rest of the people essentially were merchants shipping farm products. In other words, exporting farm products and importing manufactured goods, more or less. This is, you know, roughly true. So you start off in the world with 95% of people are farmers, and as civilization develops, as industry grows, services, all that sort of stuff, people leave the farm and go to cities and suburbs and all sorts of other places and get better jobs in other areas. So the trend of world history is against the farmers, in a sense, not against food, but in a sense that economically you leave the farm, you increase agricultural production even as you leave the farm because you get better technology, farm machinery, and all that sort of stuff, and ways of producing crops. You leave the farm, you do other things. So if you try to freeze this and say, geez, it's a terrible thing, people leaving the farm, what you're doing is you're essentially freezing the world, trying to turn back the clock and decrease productivity, decrease technology, go back to the good old days and everybody was a farmer. It's totally nuts. There's no reason why the taxpayer should subsidize this and the consumer should subsidize this kind of truly reactionary position. Because the fight against modern world, against industrialization, against everything else. But it's still going on, of course, even though right now only 6% of the population are farmers. 6%. And then for all the fuss is made about it, you think the whole world is farmers. And this is not only true in the United States, by the way. Almost every country outrageously subsidizes their own farmers. And Europe is a common market. It's supposed to be free trade between all the European countries. There's no free trade. Because every country protects its own farmers to the hilt, keeping out cheaper and better farm products from other countries. So every country has this wall of protection, around their own farmers. So the American farm situation, the farm block begins, interestingly enough, not with the farmers, didn't know what was going on mostly. It begins with a few people who are, number one, equipment manufacturers, farm machinery manufacturers, okay? Who realize if the government subsidizes a farmer, they too will be subsidized even more, as we'll see how. Farm machinery. These are guys who manufacture, you know, tractors and combines and all that sort of stuff. As you might expect, being born and bred in New York, I'm not exactly expert in agriculture. So, anyway, these are farm machinery manufacturers who begin the idea of a farm block. The first two guys, George Peake and Hugh Johnson, wrote a book called Farm Equality. Equality for Agriculture, I think, in 1921. These guys were they were chairman of the board and president of the Moline Plow Company, which those days was the second largest farm equipment machinery manufacturers. They said they wailed about the poor dirt farmer and all that junk. The other guy, Bernard Baruch, was their mentor, was a big land speculator. In other words, he bought up a lot of farmland and then pushed for subsidies to farmers so that the price of his land would go way up. This is essentially, these are the guys who begin the agitation for the farm. Of course, as they keep agitating, of course, the farmers say, hey, this is great stuff, the organized farm block, the American Farm Bureau, and Grange, that sort of thing. So anyway, during the 1920s, they keep pushing for subsidies to the poor farmer. Instead of saying, all right, let the farmer get out. In other words, the farmer's producing more than he was before. Cut back and, you know, leave the farm and all that sort of stuff. And by the way, leaving the farm doesn't mean at the age of 60 you have to leave the farm. It almost always happens as the sons grow up or daughters grow up. The sons say, oh, okay, Pop, I'm sorry, I feel like better opportunities in New York or in California or something, and they leave the farm. This is basically what happens, the new generation coming up. So it's always been that way. As I say, it's been that way since 1789, except now in the 1920s, we begin the agitation to try to stop it. 1929, Herbert Hoover becomes president. Herbert Hoover was committed to the farm block. He said if he gets to be president, the first thing he'll do is to institute a farm support, price support program, which he did. In March 1929, the infamous Federal Farm Board was created. This is the first farm price support program. March 29, done before the Depression. Don't think this is a response to the 1929 Depression. Depression hit in October, and this is before that. This attempted to be a permanent part of American policy, which, of course, unfortunately, it became. The idea is this. How do you raise the price of... Here's the price of wheat. They started with wheat, which has always been the biggest politically powerful part of agriculture. Now, of course, farm price support program, especially with almost everything, any crop you can think of has compulsory cartelization, marketing orders, limiting production, and acreage control and all that sort of stuff. But at any rate, it starts with wheat and cotton, especially with wheat. The idea is you create a federal farm board, so this starts the whole policy, which is supposed to buy up a lot of wheat. If you buy up wheat, you raise the price. In other words, you add to the regular demand by consumers and so forth. You add the federal government, which buys up stuff and increases the price, to push the price up to whatever the farmers want. So they did that. They did that by the way, the head of the Federal Farm Board. The Federal Farm Board consisted of a bunch of people, representatives of organized agriculture, wheat farmers, apple farmers from New York, things like that. But the head of it was Alexander Legge, who was the chairman of the Board of International Harvester, which, of course, was the world's foremost farm equipment manufacturing company. So this sort of International Harvester. Not exactly a dirt farmer, Alexander Legge. Probably never saw a farm, at any rate. head of International Harvester. So they buy up wheat. But see, the problem is, here's the wheat. Federal Farm Board has all this huge accumulation of wheat. What are they going to do with it? It's hanging over the market like the sword of Damocles, and the market's worried about the fact if they ever sell this stuff, the price is going to go down again. And so, as a result, nobody wanted to buy wheat. None of the speculators. They're worried because they're afraid if the government sells the wheat, they'd be out of luck. And so the price goes pushed up a little bit and goes down again immediately. They couldn't do it. In other words, they couldn't just push up. What are they going to do with all this excess of wheat or excess cotton? And also they found out that by trying to raise the price of wheat, they stimulated further wheat production, which made the problem even worse. So, and of course when the Depression hit, it's even more so, because the Depression oil prices tended to fall, and they're trying to push up wheat prices in the face of all this general price collapse. So, finally, by the end of the Hoover administration, by about 1932, they realized the only way to try to raise farm prices in a quasi-permanent manner is to organize the farmers as a cartel. In other words, the Secretary of Agriculture went and told the farmers, campaigned all over the country, even his agents and so forth, and they told the farmers this. They hold meetings of farmers, tobacco farmers, wheat farmers, cotton farmers, milk farmers, and all that. They said, look, explain to them economics of the situation. They said, if all of you cut production, if you voluntarily cut production, let's say by 20%, prices will go up 30% or 40%, and you'll all benefit. In other words, he's telling them that the demand curve for their product is inelastic. It probably was. I mean, there's no proof for it. He was probably right. So the demand curve for wheat or cotton or oats or whatever was inelastic. Therefore, if you all band together and cut production by 10%, prices go up by 30% or whatever. In other words, the total revenue will increase. You can all share the benefits. Now, of course, who loses by this? Who loses? The consumer loses. The consumer now has to pay higher price for a lower product. The suckers, especially during the Depression, everybody was poor. We now have to pay a much higher price for less wheat, less cotton, fewer pigs, that sort of thing, fewer cattle. The farmers would benefit, consumers would lose, and the taxpayers would lose insofar as we have to buy up, spend a lot of money buying this stuff up, as the Federal Farm Board would say. So they told the farmers this. They said, okay, remember, cut production next year by 10% or 15%, whatever the thing is, and prices will go up double, and you'll be much better off. Each farmer then went back to his own home and thought to himself, farmers are not stupid, especially about their own pocketbook. He said, look, if these suckers out there, they're going to cut their prices, we cut production, raise prices, I'm going to double my production and take advantage of the higher price, right? Of course. In other words, each farmer is going down his own demand curve, so to speak. As a result of that, of course, instead of production going up, going down, it went up. They're worse off than they were before. Again, demonstrating that cartels don't work. I'm going to repeat this later on in the course when I get to monopolies and cartels. Cartels don't work unless the government enforces it. Voluntary cartels don't work, because everybody will say to himself, aha, I'm going to take advantage and increase my production while the other suckers cut theirs. A good, solid American trait. So then they started, organized farmers started with random violence. For example, tobacco crops, the same thing happened with tobacco. They said, well, if you cut your production by 10%, tobacco prices go up by 20%. Each guy increases tobacco production. Tobacco farmers started sort of Ku Klux Klan activities. As a matter of fact, They were the Ku Klux Klan, usually, in North Carolina and so forth. They went and started burning tobacco fields. They felt the guy increases production. There was a lot of that. On the other hand, it's this core of, you know, first it's illegal and it's random and it's not gonna, you know, it's not systematic, say the least. They also did that with milk. They dumped out, they saw milk trucks and they felt that it was going beyond their informal milk quota. They went and dumped the milk out on the road. But as I say, these things were random violence and they obviously were not systematic and therefore not successful. So by the end of the Hoover administration, the farm bloc and the Hoover administration itself came to the conclusion the only thing that would work was government coercion. In other words, the government has to force the farmers, quote, for their own good, unquote, to cut production. So force them into a cartel, very much like Bismarck in Germany forced the German industry into a cartel. So that means an individual, so once again, what's happening then is you force them to cut production, it means that individual farmers might do better on their own or forced to go along with this general process of monopoly and shafting the consumer. So when Roosevelt came in 1933, this is exactly what he did. He took the farm program and systematically employed government coercion to try to force farmers to grow less, setting out the AAA, the American Agricultural, excuse me, Agricultural Adjustment Administration. Official name of it. a vast bureaucracy in the Department of Agriculture that trying to force farmers to setting maximum quotas to force farmers to cut production so they can raise price and all benefit by the cartel. That was the concept. Now this is pretty outrageous. For example, it was a famous example. They try to force the farmers to cut their pig production by one third, the number of pigs they raised. It's the middle of the Depression and lots of people were starving in the cities. Here they're organizing agriculture in the name of a, quote, welfare state, which was a New Deal of alleged contribution to American economy, to cut production and raise prices while people were starving in the cities. I don't call that a welfare in any true sense, a welfare system. Okay? This is a welfare state in action. at any rate, so they figured, however, they couldn't, it would be difficult to cut production directly. To cut production, which they're doing now in a lot of cases, however, tobacco and all sorts of other peanuts. The cut production means you have to police everybody's output. You have to have some kind of way of policing marketing to make sure that Zeke Jones' farmer doesn't produce more than his quota. They figured an easier way to do this is to cut his acreage. Because acreage is visible. The Department of Agriculture county agent can drive around the county and find out how many acres Zeke Jones is, cultivating wheat. Very easy to see. So acreage is a visible thing. Instead of having production quotas, cutting production by a certain amount, they can force them to cut acreage because it's more easy to enforce. So they put on acreage control, maximum acreage. Okay, so in other words, if maximum acreage quotas. So let's say here's Zeke Jones, wheat farmer in Kansas, and he's say 100 acres devoted to wheat. They tell them everybody's got to cut their wheat acreage by 20%. You have to take 20 acres out of production and only have 80 acres worth of wheat. By doing that, they thought they would cut production by 20%. You cut acreage by 20%, you cut production by 20%, right? Wrong. It's not the way it worked. The farmers indeed obeyed the law in most cases and cut their acreage. However, farmers are smart. They said, here's what we're going to do. They're forcing us to cut acreage. What we'll do is we'll take our 20 lousiest acres. Because acres are not all the same. One acre is not the same as every other acre. Take your rocky soil, stuff is no damn good anyway, you take that out of production, and you concentrate all your best efforts on the 80 acres. You take the 80 best acres, and you mechanize. And then you use fertilizer and irrigate, and that's exactly what they did. They wound up producing more than they did before, more of the 80 acres than they produced 100 acres. So this means, here's the government trying to push farm prices up. Okay. And it's a little clearer here. And so they have acreage, but they wind up with all the stuff being produced, more being produced. They're out here now, and the government's got to buy up all this stuff because the government's committed to pushing prices up to here. So the government, the Department of Agriculture, buys up. It's called loans, but it's really buying up. It's buying up all the excess amount that drives to push the prices up to here. So instead of having the farmers cutting production, they cut acreage to increase production, and the farm of agriculture has to buy up even more. Storing all sorts of useless wheat that's been producing cotton and cheese nowadays and all that sort of stuff, storing it in bins somewhere, and just letting them, by one say, rot, refrigerating them, just keeping them there for almost forever. So this is essentially what's happened for the last 50 years, in one form or another, different variations. It's more than that, though. It's even crazier than that. The Department of Agriculture, one division of the Department of Agriculture, is trying to pay the farmers, in other words, subsidize them to grow less, right? In other words, they're buying up all this stuff and trying to get raising the price and getting them to grow less. Another division of the Department of Agriculture, at the same time, is subsidizing the farmers to grow more. Subsidizing irrigation, a huge amount of subsidized irrigation now and before, even more so now, but subsidizing fertilizers, subsidizing all sorts of agricultural techniques, and subsidizing them with rural electrification to electrify every farm. So on the one hand, you have the Department of Agriculture subsidizing farmers to grow more, subsidizing with cheap electricity, cheap water, that sort of stuff. On the other hand, subsidizing them to grow less. Now, economists would call this an irrational policy. The standard economic discussion was irrational because it's contradictory. If you look at it from a realistic point of view, it's not irrational from the point of view of two sets of people. From the point of view of the farmers, they're in great shape. They're getting paid to grow less, and they're also getting paid to grow more. What better shape are you going to be in if you're a farmer? And also from the point of view of the Department of Agriculture, they're in great shape. Their bureaucracy is expanding like mad, right, with two huge bureaucratic empires, one wing down the hall subsidizing farmers to grow less, the other wing to grow more. They're in great shape, too. Who's getting screwed by this? The taxpayers and the consumers, plus the economy as a whole, of course, looking at it from the point of view of a kind of rational system. But it's not irrational from the point of view of the farmers and the Department of Agriculture. So those two groups benefit at the expense of the rest of us is really what this is. Right now, for example, with the water, I think I might have mentioned with the so-called water shortage, the water system in the West, where there's very, very little amount of water to begin with, the government's growing huge dams, building huge dams, subsidizing farmers with cheap water. It's a very high cost to the taxpayer. The latest Central Arizona project, I think it's costing the taxpayer three times as much as they charge the farmers for water. And it was very, very cheap water, wasting a huge amount of water. And then, because water is scarce there, so they're artificially making the price of water low, they're forcing the farmers to use it as fast as possible. The farmers then grow a lot of crops, cotton, wheat, etc., which then the government buys up because they want to raise the price. In other words, they subsidize the farmers to grow more so then they can, the government can buy them up because they want them to grow less. I mean, totally nuts from any point of view except that of the farmer and the Department of Agriculture. So that's the basic policy. Now, there have been certain variations over the years. For one thing, as with the energy question, as with oil, as the farm price went up permanently, it means that people started importing more farm products from abroad, obviously. It means that now American wheat or cotton or peanuts is much more expensive than European or South American. And then they start moving to prohibit imports or tariffs, high tariffs or quotas on imports or saying Argentinian meat is disease. That's a big thing, by the way, if you're importing meat. First, you artificially jack up meat prices by farm price allocations and controls, prices of pork and beef, etc. And then people start importing more beef, let's say, from Argentina, and then you say, it's diseased. Create a phony disease scare and ban the imports of foreign meat. So all these things then are a way of forcing the cartel for foreign products as well as American. And sometimes when the world price goes up, in other words, sometimes during this, the 60-year period, agriculture prices are high, and then we unload the surplus. In other words, the surplus, then we were able to sell stuff abroad. But in most cases, most of the time, American prices have been way above the world market price, and so we're stuck with these piling up. What do we do with the surplus? Well, who knows? They get very embarrassing as they pile up. They cost money to the taxpayer and to the consumer. Sometimes they're dumped abroad. One of the reasons for the food stamp program is they're able to get rid of the surpluses through the food stamp program. The major lobbyists for food stamps are not the welfare people. They're the farm bloc. The farm bloc wants another kind of guaranteed income for the farmers, a guaranteed way of siphoning the stuff off so they can build out more surpluses. The major lobbyists for the farm program are one, as I mentioned, the farm equipment manufacturers, farm machinery manufacturers, The big farmers, the small farmers, don't really care that. Many of the small farmers are hurt by the program because the subsidy is per bushel of wheat or per pound of cotton. The subsidy is per pound rather than income subsidy. The small farmers usually lose out because they have to cut their acreage. They can't mechanize that much. And the wheat situation, there's a so-called wheat democracy. Every 3 years, I think it is, the farmers can get together and vote on whether they should continue the farm price support program. That's great. I mean, we can't vote. We're not allowed to vote on this. There's a referendum for wheat farmers. Should they continue this outrageous subsidy to wheat farmers? And actually, they always vote for it. Except the small farmers are not allowed to vote. Those who have less than 100 acres or less than 1,000 acres, whatever they, I think it's 100 acres, can't vote because they probably will vote against the program. In other words, only large farmers can vote, and so that actually the large farmers and middle-sized farmers always vote to continue this thing. Another thing that happens is this, that when they pour in fertilizer and irrigation, etc., and the mechanization to the extra 80 acres, they mechanize more than they would have with 100 acres. When they mechanize more than they would have, especially helps the farm equipment manufacturers. You see how this works. In other words, you're forced to cut out 20 acres, so you take the other 80 acres and you mechanize it, so you have to maximize it, intensively produce on the 80 acres that are left. This tremendously helps the farm equipment, of course, farmers then buy a lot of farm machinery. This is one of the big reasons, which is only discovered recently by historians, one of the big reasons for the big migration of blacks from the south to the north in the early 1930s, namely most of the blacks in the rural areas and the cotton areas in the south were sharecroppers. In other words, they were sort of a kind of tenant on large wheat farms. And they would pay a certain amount of the production to the wheat farmer. In other words, they pay in peat, like sort of proportion of the wheat that they produced. So the first thing they did when the farmers decided they had to mechanize because their acreage was cut, was to kick out the sharecroppers and then mechanize on the other 80 acres. So all of a sudden, a lot of these black cotton farmers in the south were suddenly unemployed. They were suddenly tossed out on the labor market and they migrated to the north. And so a lot of them, of course, were in very desperate straits. And this starts a lot of the whole welfare problem, the migration north and welfare problem, created, in other words, by the New Deal agricultural program, which was supposed to bring us the welfare state and help all of mankind. That's applause. Okay, the other big lobbyist for this program, that's our high-tech heating system here. The other big lobbyists for the farm program are the warehouse owners. The government stores all the surplus stuff in warehouses. Almost all of them are private warehouses. They're not government-owned warehouses. They contract in private warehouses. If you own a private grain elevator, which is the term used for a wheat warehouse, you're in great shape. You have like a steady contract forever. You always be government surpluses. If your brother-in-law happens to be a big shot in the power of agriculture, you have it made for life. You have like a permanent contract for 2 million bushels of wheat to be stored in your damn warehouse. They're called grain elevators, by the way, because they're very tall for various reasons. So there's an elevator, sort of like a belt that carries the wheat up. Don't ask me any more of the technology of this. Anyway, so the warehouse owners lobby intensively in their areas for the farm program, the big farmers and the farm machinery manufacturers. These are the three major groups. Of course, when they want to testify before Congress, they always trot out some poor dirt farmer. They don't talk about the warehouse owners and large farmers. So what's happened? The next big innovation, this thing came in the Eisenhower administration. Next big step forward or backward, the farm program. What happens to the 20 acres? If they can't grow wheat or cotton on it, they grow something else, soybeans, let's say, or turnips, whatever it is. And so eventually, this is our substitutability here. Here's wheat, let's say. So wheat is forced up, and the acreage is forced out or whatever, okay? So the acreage control is imposed. The 20 acres are then devoted, let's say, to soybeans. That means there's an increase in soybean production. Supply of soybeans increases. I mean, wheat prices are driven up, although it's only acreage is full, really not production. And then the supply of soybeans goes up, and the price of soybeans fall. So the farmers started a bellyache. This is a terrible thing because there's a fall in the price of soybeans and turnips and all these things which are they're using these 20 acres for. So the Eisenhower administration has one another big advance in this whole nonsense, creating a new concept called a soil bank. Again, a great term, soil bank. It sounds terrific, right? The soil bank is this. In order to prevent these red soybeans or turnips from being produced, you pay the farmers more if they keep this whole lot of production. They just keep the land idle. They don't grow anything on it. It's called a soil bank. Keep the soil with nothing on it and nothing growing in it. In other words, you pay the farmers, the great innovation of the Eisenhower administration, you pay the farmers not to do anything at all, not to grow anything. And they still do that, of course. Any time they have an innovation, it becomes a permanent part of the American soil heritage. So this, of course, is a great deal if you can swing it. It'd be great if I could be paid a lot of money not to teach economics. A few guys could be paid a lot of money not to be engineers. And you'd see how the world economy would progress with this. So this, as I said, this is still there. I mean, they're still taking land out of production and just making it sit there because to make sure that all prices can be pushed up instead of just some prices. During the Nixon administration, there was talk about eliminating the thing, all farm price supports altogether. They actually passed a law, sort of a three-tier law or something, a stopgap, but that's also still in, it gets to be very complex legal structure. All these things get larded on top of each other. But anyway, for a while there, when world agriculture prices were fairly high, they were talking about eliminating the farm price support program. That's now out the window, of course. They're back worse than ever. What the Reagan administration did to their innovation, making it even worse, is called PIC, called Payments in Kind Program, P-I-K, where they pay the farmers still more if they agree to cut production by half or something. In other words, they'll pay them back. It goes like this. Let's say the government stored up a lot of wheat. Okay, so they tell the farmers, if you cut your production from here to here, we will pay you back in the wheat we've stored up. In other words, we'll pay you the wheat and you can then sell it. So this way you try to unload your surpluses. And if you cut your production in half, we will then supply you with wheat from our storage free. It's called payments in kind programs. Another form of subsidy. It hasn't worked at all. As a matter of fact, generally in a state of collapse in a couple of years, the farmers are worse off. What's happening now is the farmers are now bellyaching about being in a state of depression. And the reason is, it's very similar to why the railroads are a state of permanent collapse after 100 years of government regulation and the airlines almost collapsed before deregulation. It's because after a long time of this sort of stuff, the whole industry gets inefficient and monopolistic and, you know, falls apart. The farmers in particular have a sort of a penchant when they're in good shape, when things are going well, when prices are going up, means their land values are going up. They borrow heavily, speculating an increase in their land values. They borrow and they mortgage their farms to the hilt, they mortgage their houses to the hilt because things are going up. Well, of course, prices, you know, rise and fall just like anything else. And when the farm prices go up, they plunge heavily and borrow to the hilt. When farm prices go down, they get caught short because now they have to pay up. And prices are lower, they can't afford their mortgage payments, and they're, you know, losing out. Then, of course, they turn to the federal government for aid. For some reason, they are the darlings of American life. They're sons of the soil. They've got the pitchfork and all that nonsense. Actually, probably none of them have seen a pitchfork. It's all mechanized anyway. And then they come running to the government. No, we're the farmers. We have to preserve American soil, American character, and all that crap. And so they usually get bailed out. And so it's an amazing thing because, as I say, there are very few farmers left. There's only 6% of the population is farmers. Yet somehow we still think has this mystique of the farm. And so almost invariably they get bailed out. But the result is, in the long run, after many years, decades of this, they're worse off, in a sense worse off than before. They're heavily in debt. They can't pay the debt. And of course the government says, okay, we'll bail you out, give you a long-term loan, and we'll half pay out your mortgage or whatever. But there's a big campaign of crying about the farm problem now. So this happened over the last 60 years. So now it's sort of institutionalized. It's almost part of the American heritage. In the case of tobacco, there's now marketing orders. There are specific orders for different products. In the case of tobacco, it's even weirder. It's very much like the taxi medallion, which we'll get to later on in the course, where, or like the oil import program. In case of tobacco, not only are there these farm price support programs and acreage controls and all that, there's also tremendous cut in supply or restriction on land. And you have to own the right to produce tobacco. In other words, supposing I buy a farm and I can grow tobacco on it. For example, Pennsylvania, lots of farms which can grow tobacco. Let's say it hasn't been growing it recently. I buy the farm, I start growing tobacco. I can't do that. It's illegal. I have to buy the right to produce tobacco. And the right is carefully restricted. So, in other words, I have to buy a farm which now produces tobacco and can only produce a certain amount. So it's all very restricted. The price, of course, becomes a monopoly price, which carries with it the right to produce tobacco. In other words, if you have a certain amount of land here, let's say the value of the land, tobacco land, is, let's say $1,000 an acre, something like that. If the price is $1,000 an acre, but land is so priced that you can't grow tobacco on land which doesn't have the federal right to grow tobacco stamped on it, so to speak, like a taxing medallion. Then the price goes way up. It's maybe $5,000 an acre, whatever the price is, to cover, give you the monopoly right to produce tobacco, which is conferred upon you by the federal government. So the result is you have a huge increase in land prices for tobacco land, but tobacco farmers are cleaning up. In other words, they get not only the farm price support increase, they get the land monopoly. So you're very tightly restricting the amount of land that can be used for tobacco. It's like medallions, which we'll get to later on. There's 11,747 taxis in New York with medallions on it, and it's been the same way since 1937, 50 years, with an absolutely fixed amount of taxis. So, the result, in order to buy a license, well, I'll get into that later on, but to buy a license for a cab, it used to be $10. When you go down and get a license, you prove you can drive a cab, you buy your cab for whatever the price is, plus the $10 for a license. That was it. That was from until 1937. 1937, to help out the cab industry, in the Depression, they decided to issue no further licenses. And there have been no further licenses from that day till this. 50 years of no license. In order to buy a license, therefore, to drive a cab, you have to buy it from somebody else, because the total is restricted. Very much the same in tobacco, agriculture, tobacco land. So that means there's a market price for the license, for the medallion, because you can't get it from the New York City government. You have to get it from a guy who's willing to sell his taxi. And the result is, it's now a little over $100,000. Note that. In other words, the price of a taxi license was $10 in 37. It's now $105,000. So this means in order to own a taxi, you have to go deeply into hock or whatever. You have to have a huge capital investment. And, Mayor Koch a few years ago had a pretty good idea. His idea is, well, in order to break this thing, he would give each taxi owner right now another medallion, another license, free, provided he or somebody else uses it within a year or something. In other words, the guy would have to then sell it to somebody else. And they still refused to do it, the taxi people. They fought like hell. They were afraid of any increase in supply. They wanted to keep their monopoly price. They were worried about even getting a free license. They're worried about the demand curve, basically. They're worried that they might have a loss in total revenue. So they hung onto it. And since the taxi association lawyer for the Taxi Association in New York is a famous or infamous boss, absolute boss of the Bronx democracy, Stanley Friedman, who virtually controls the city council, any attempt by any mayor to sort of break the monopoly has been going to defeat. Stanley Friedman, of course, was involved in the famous parking license bureau scandal. He's an elegant-looking guy with a goatee. I'll go into this further when we get to monopoly, because it shows you various ramifications of this. But these various methods to tighten up the whole system to try to make sure that there's no increase in supply of product. To cut, in other words, not only cut acreage but also cut production, make the thing even tighter. There was a peanut shortage I meant to bring this in. I have an old clipping from Newsweek. About 6-7 years ago, there was a big peanut shortage, a peanut crop failure in Georgia. And so there was a big peanut butter shortage, running amounted to. Not only is there a price support program for peanuts, there's also a big acreage restriction, and marketing restrictions, production restrictions, everything else you can think of. Very tight control on the peanut situation, which which of course more or less triples the price of peanut butter, by the way. So, yeah, they try to, since there was a big peanut butter shortage, I mean, big drop in production, they try to import. Of course, there's also big import quotas because peanut butter from, I forget who makes it, other countries make peanut butter. Big, huge difference in price. They have big restrictions on peanut butter imports. So, poor Skippy, Skippy and the other peanut butter makers, of course, were petitioning the government, please let us import some cheap peanuts because we can't get any peanuts here. So they're very reluctant to do it. They allowed a little bit of import for 1 year. Very temporary, of course, so Skippy can produce some peanut butter. And they very grudgingly allow them to do it as a very temporary basis. You can only do this for 6 months and then we crack down again. So this way the consumer is being shafted across the board for all these special interest groups. The New York Times, by the way, which is usually in favor of all these subsidy programs, is pretty sound on the farm question. There's not too many farmers reading the New York Times here. They're much more urban oriented, and at least they can see this, the craziness of this program. There's no attempt, even though most of the Reagan economists are against the program. It's almost impossible politically to break the hold of this. For example, Senator Jesse Helms, a very powerful senator from North Carolina, is the big, even though allegedly in favor of the free market, is the big proponent, of course, of tobacco monopoly, tobacco price control, more, bigger, bigger, higher, higher. By the way, another thing about tobacco, another little bit of nuttiness here, is that one wing of the government, the Department of Agriculture, is constantly subsidizing more and more higher subsidies to tobacco farmers. And the other wing is insisting on putting warnings on every package of cigarettes, warnings that are dangerous to your health, will produce cancer, and so on. So one wing of the government is warning you against tobacco, the other wing is subsidizing it to the hilt. Again, it's only irrational from the point of view of the consumer and the taxpayer and the economy as a whole. It's not irrational from the point of view of tobacco farmers and whatever, the Department of Agriculture and government inspectors, all of whom sort of multiply under this program. So again, what we have here is a giant cartel organized in agriculture, organized by the federal government, enforced by the federal government, so as to prevent any individual farmer, producer from breaking the cartel, from increasing his production, and various attempts to get around it. Once again, it's a conflict between government and the market. You have a control, you try to get around it, and you tighten up the control some more. Okay, if you get around the acreage control, you produce more. Okay, we'll have production control, plus further subsidies. Of course, the subsidies never end. They're added on to. As I say, even though there are very few farmers left, even in the Midwest, even in places that are supposed to be farm areas, there seems to be no way to get rid of this thing. For one thing, there's log rolling in Congress. Each group wants to have their own shtick, wants to have their own subsidy. So the farm people say, okay, I'll vote for your thing. I'll vote for New York subsidies if you vote for our subsidies. And there's general agreement then to carry the whole thing with them, increase the whole pressure. I'll bring in next time some examples. I'll try to get that peanut butter example. It's kind of cute. Yeah. Okay. See you Thursday.